You're listening to Law and Liberty, the official podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation, where we're proclaiming the authority of God's Word over every area of life and thought. Today, you are joined by your host, Martin Celbretti and Andrea Schwartz.
Welcome to the Law and Liberty podcast of February 17th, 2010. My name is Andrea Schwartz, and I'm here with Martin Celbretti, Vice President and Resident Scholar at Chalcedon. Welcome, Martin.
Always a pleasure.
Okay. Well, today we are on Chapter 6 of the book Law and Liberty by R.J. Rushdoony, and the title of that chapter is Law in the Future. And I think we'll be able to get into some pretty timely discussions because of Dr. Rushdoony's discussion of the contrast between how a Christian views the future and how a humanist views the future. But one of the interesting observations he makes right at the beginning of the chapter is that man is not alone in planning for the future. And he points out that animals do so by building nests, going to other climates, etc., but they do it instinctively. Man does it differently. How does man demonstrate the fact that he's above the creatures, Martin, by how he plans for the future?
Well, he plans in terms of an actual vision of the future. He is able to foresee in advance the results of his planning, and he can change his future in effect. This is not the case with the animals, who are, as you said, instinctively driven to do certain things in preparation for the future. Man doesn't do it by instinct, but by vision.
Which is an interesting differentiation. How would the evolutionist ever account for that change in man if we're just merely the further development of, you know, the animals and originally from the primordial ooze?
It's a question for them to answer.
Right, right. We can't answer that one. He makes the point, though, that how you view the future bears a lot on health and prosperity because there's a correlation between those who have an optimistic view and those who don't.
That's correct. He cites hospital statistics of those who don't anticipate living around for, say, a week or more, and they generally don't tend to live more than a week. Those who have a future vision of, say, a month, they tend to last about a month. So if you believe your future is blocked, as they say, you tend to make that a self-fulfilling prophecy. Without hope for a future, you basically block that future from being realized.
Well, how is that different than just the power of positive thinking? Would our future be better if we just thought in positive terms?
No, because the person who conceives of a future also has a motive to work for that future. That's a very different thing than positive thinking, which anticipates everything just happening because your thoughts are positive and it comes to you naturally. The only feedback that we see is covenantal feedback, where faithfulness to God's law and covenant does have positive ramifications for our future and the future of our children and children's children. So it's a very different thing than a positive thinking orientation is.
Right. Well, Rushdoony makes the point that Western man's vision of the future for the longest time had been Christian and biblical. And yet you and I both have been born and grown up in an era where the Christian roots were very heavily supplanted by Enlightenment and humanistic thinking. So how is the triumph of Christ and the victory that the Bible talks about, what are the ramifications of that outlook? And then what's the ramifications of this utopian dream of we're going to evolve to a higher state than we are now?
Well, the Bible has delivered us from human planning for the future in the sense that the future is no longer something that man is responsible for in terms of mapping it out step by step because he's operating in a background of chaos in a godless area where man brings reason, order, stability, if you will, man against nature. in a Christian setting, the future is in God's hands, and so the future is realized by being part of the kingdom's forward motion. In other words, being kings and priests under the King of Kings and Lord of Lords secures the future, not in terms of going it alone, rejecting God, and saying the future must be planned as if God doesn't exist. In fact, the future is most safely planned if you omit God and put man back on his own resources. So that's what humanism gives us, is a plan for the future that omits God so that man can be God, and man can then determine the future as God versus God determining it. So when we shifted off of a Christian basis, we had no choice but to move to more and more social planning in order to realize the future. The future then is couched or framed in terms of a humanistic vision where man takes control of man, a theme that we see throughout this book of Rashtunis.
Well, to the uninitiated or someone new to the topic, it would seem then that the Christian view has a very low view of man, whereas the humanistic view says man's a capable entity and he can do things for himself. Why do you suppose many people have the view that this biblical view gives man less power and less freedom?
Well, in a sense, the humanist has discounted the notion of the fall. Their view is that man's problem is not sin, it's inadequate knowledge, not enough science or technology, and not enough social engineering. That's the whole point about man taking control. If man takes better control of himself, of his race, or his destiny, then all will be well. And so the solution from a humanistic point of view is increased controls. And from a Christian point of view, it's the problem is not lack of control or lack of knowledge. It's sin. It is violating God's laws that are creating havoc and putting a hell on earth. So the solutions are completely different. And I think Rashtuni makes it clear, and I might be jumping the gun on you here, Andrea, that science fiction has started to become more realistic in terms of seeing a dystopia, a hell on earth versus a utopia, a heaven on earth that is a result of humanistic planning and thinking. A lot of the science fiction is seeing that when man uses his technology, that's not usually at the service of the ultimate good, even in terms of their framework. It ends up with evil having more and more power, tyranny being empowered through technology, a bigger bomb, a more poisonous nerve gas. These are the things, a longer trajectory on a weapon, things on this order. So man has basically used technology, and his technology has outrun his moral ability to use that technology.
Right. In the chapter, he differentiates between the communist science fiction that only sees a steady triumph of scientific socialism and the fact that in the U.S., we have a schizophrenic view. We still have this hope for technology and science, but there's this awareness or the sense that man doesn't know what to do with all this power. And he makes a very interesting statement. He says, the American is ready to believe in sin and depravity, but not in salvation.
Correct. It's like they say, more people believe in the devil than believe in Jesus Christ. And that's because when humanism is unleashed in the world, we see the effects of the devil's doctrine, which is men should take control of man. And he gives a good counsel in terms of how to achieve that. And that's the devil's job, if you will, to put forward the agenda of Genesis 3:5, you shall be as gods, determining for yourselves what is good and evil, rather than God being the determiner of good and evil. So again, Satan subtly shifts the balance in saying man's problem is lack of knowledge, lack of scientific knowledge, and the future can be secured by a better awareness, better education, and socializing people so that we can secure the future we want for our grandchildren. And that's the message that Satan basically put across to Eve. You shall be as gods, knowing things that you don't know now. You lack knowledge. You lack the power to determine and be your own arbiter of right and wrong.
How much do you think the advent of film and television in the 20th century and the ability to visualize the science fiction of so many humanists who were trying to eliminate God from the picture, do you think that's had a significant effect on our culture today?
It has enabled us to accept as the norm the idea of a humanistic utopia in the future. Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was definitely a strong humanist, and he wanted to set forth a humanistic vision of the future. Now, of course, he had to have drama, so he had to have some level of sin or evil in his plots so that people have something to overcome. But ultimately, he was optimistic over the long term, which is ironic because in the long term, the universe suffers a heat death and everyone's dead anyway. So it's ironic to me that we even put these kinds of ideas forth without thinking them through properly.
And I remember after coming to an understanding of the Bible from a Reformed theonomic Reconstructionist perspective, the prime directive in Star Trek is the exact opposite of the Great Commission. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to go and make disciples of all nations. We're supposed to go and actually influence every culture we come in contact with. And yet, of course, the joke in Star Trek was they had this stated directive, but they always involved themselves and interfered in every culture.
Yes, the difference is that the Great Commission is set against the backdrop of sin being a tremendous evil that has engulfed the world that needs to be addressed forthrightly and aggressively through the propagation of the gospel through the ministry of the word, though this be foolishness to the natural man. And of course, in a Star Trek type of universe, the natural realm is regarded as normal and good, and therefore should not be tampered with. That would be the evil thing to tamper with these very good cultures. In fact, it's ironic that if there's evil in a Star Trek universe, it tends to be from the human side.
Right.
How do they account for it arising in an alien environment? By the way, we don't believe there are such things as aliens. But it's been very interesting to quite a few observers. I'm thinking of Doug Phillips in particular, who's pinpointed the fact that lots of times the savior in science fiction are the little green men, as he says.
Right.
These aliens come in and save the day. They, from the day the Earth stood still, when they come on down and say it's time for you guys to straighten out, to the most, I would say, cynical science fiction that's been around. But it's the premise is that we are saved by the little green men. So we see salvation not within Christ, but rather search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Because, again, if man's problem is not enough knowledge, maybe the aliens know more. In fact, by definition, they know more because they're able to reach across thousands of light years of space to come visit us. Therefore, by definition, they are superior, and we should listen to what they have to say. And therefore, salvation naturally comes from greater knowledge, which comes from the evolutionary mindset that these other alleged cultures have something we don't have, which is thousands of years past their development of nuclear weapons and whatnot.
Exactly. So our vision of the future is then shaped by this idea that as we continue on the evolutionary journey, we'll attain to something better. Yet, interestingly enough, as it's been said over and over again, the 20th century was one of the bloodiest centuries of all history. And there was much social planning that went on during the 20th century. It wasn't a lack of social planning. It was just a social planning that was divorced from God's law.
That is correct. In fact, the science fiction aficionados have to explain away the 20th century. They go out of their way to pinpoint it and say it was a miracle that mankind survived this glitch in its upward evolutionary path. So they are apologists for man and say, fortunately, we got past that adolescent cycle, if you will, and our tantrums and wise up, why became sharper like the rest of the aliens are.
Right. They never quite say how that came about. It just did. It just happened. Mm-hmm. Rush also makes the point in this chapter that we're discussing that the Constitution was written as a plan for the future, as a social plan for the future, but it was informed by a knowledge that man needed to be under a system of checks and balances because of his propensity for sin. That's not how people view the Constitution today, who want to shape it into all sorts of meanings and intents that it never really had.
Mm-hmm. It's now perceived of as a blank check. Because if the founders were Calvinists, then by definition they're wrong, and we should rewrite the document or treat it in terms of our modern sensibilities, which is that man's fundamentally good and should be entrusted with more and more power. And therefore, the social planning function comes into play. So, and what Rush does is he connects the concept of law to the future. Whatever laws you set in place in a culture will determine the future of that culture. And so grasping the reins of law enables someone to control the future, at least to an extent.
Right.
And it was the intention of the constitutional founders to set in motion a society that would be premised on the notion, again, that man is a fallen creature and needs to be regenerated. And because we cannot trust him, we need to chain him down, as they say, with the chains of the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And this will best secure a freedom for our progeny if they're willing to operate within a Christian worldview.
And so very much built into this is the idea that this Constitution was for a nation that had its roots and its orientation on the Bible. I forget which of the founding fathers who said this Constitution is good, but it won't, this is a paraphrase, but it's not much good if the people aren't going to be self-governing.
Correct. And once you erase the Christian self-government component, then you have to, again, import regulation, and then government shapes things. And so the future, again, is seen in terms of the current plans. If we want a better future in humanism, we need to change the laws, because then those will then shape man's morality and or his expectations. We can change him as a scientific experiment, if you will. So again, science has a big part to play in the way the future is going to be shaped.
And that's really what we were talking about last time in terms of positive law and status law, that rather than repentance and conversion making men better, the state is going to legislate men better.
Correct.
In which case, we have a conflict that doesn't look like it will resolve anytime soon, notwithstanding the Winter Olympic opening ceremony where all the nations of the world supposedly come together and we're going to find peace and understanding through sports, because what really has taken place is, as the United States has embraced more of this statist law, more and more of the Christian underpinnings are becoming things of the distant past.
Very much so. I am reminded of a comment that Otto Scott made when he was watching the opening ceremonies of the 1984 Olympics in California, and he turned to everyone and basically said, bread and circuses.
Uh-huh.
The Roman approach to appease the populace that all is well and that our vision for a common mankind, a common humanity, will live on. In the meantime, of course, there's untold misery and torture and evil in the world. This is a thin veneer, and if you just push on it a little bit, it collapses.
Right, and you can see that certainly with the more overtly communistic and socialistic countries around the world, very much the winning of a medal is geared to vindicate their political system. And it's amazing to me how the media uses all sorts of theological terms in terms of the sports. So the person who didn't win a gold medal last time but is trying again this time is looking for redemption. And when you hear and you see the little vignettes that they do, they elevate the fact that some of the coaches from China haven't seen their families for years because they're putting everything into the sport. And even there was this married couple that put aside married life and they were willing to live in the dormitories, she in the women's dormitory, he in the men's dormitory, because getting this gold medal. So really we have this constant push to instill an idea of nationalism and statism into the mix as opposed to family. Somehow or other, I was supposed to think it was a wonderful thing that this man's team got the gold medal because of all his sacrifice. So we hear sacrifice, we hear redemption, trying very, very hard to speak to people on an inescapably religious way, because that's all people are, religious.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when the chief end of man is no longer the glory of God and enjoying him forever, but rather some goal internal to the universe, something immanent, as we say, that we can touch and feel like a gold medal around your neck. And then the praise of the crowd and the playing of the anthem, all these things create an existential moment But the future is not going to be determined by those things. Those things are fleeting. As the Latin phrase goes, sic transit gloria mundi. Passes along the glory of the world.
Right.
And it's a veneer again. It's a good word to use. The trappings of a glorious future are there, but that was also true for Imperial Rome in the Circensian Games, in the gladiatorial combats. The crowds loved it. It was extremely popular, but it was simply there to anesthetize the crowds, the populace, against the real troubles that the people were in. So they were diversionary and created a rallying cry, but always a false one, again, in terms of the state being the fundamental unit of culture.
Right. And so one of the things I've noticed, not just in the Olympic Games, but in any sports contest, you see oftentimes very successful athletes, those who have taken their sport seriously and done a good job, when they go to profess faith in Christ, that appears to be the biggest no-no they can do. They're supposed to be quiet, play football or play baseball, but there's this sense that we need liberation from God and from religion, and that it's very wrong to mix it. So recently in the Super Bowl commercials, which everybody tends to watch, there was a rather innocuous, quite frankly, if you looked at it on the surface, a well-known football player thanking his mom for having given him life because she had had a difficult pregnancy. And the likes of Planned Parenthood and feminist groups were up in arms because this was going to be division. And this was a quote. This is the time, the Super Bowl is the time where we all come together and we see no reason why someone should try to bring a divisive message in this. And the message was, when we actually watched it, we were all saying, that was the message? That was they were so upset about? But of course, the implications are huge if what you want to do is divorce men from God and religion.
And that is correct. It seems to me that, at least in the Olympic setting, we might be paying a price for the fact that Emperor Theodosius outlawed the Olympic Games way back, and it took a Frenchman to bring them back into the world.
Uh-huh.
So perhaps they haven't forgiven us for Emperor Theodosius's banning of those games.
Maybe not. So how would you sum up the difference between the future?
Let me say this real quick.
Sure.
One of the things that the Baron de Coubertin had in mind by bringing the games back was to create this camaraderie between the nations. Except it was in terms of amateur sport versus state-sponsored sport. But everything mutates towards statism and state sponsorship because the plan is always in terms of humanistic man, and it always moves. That's the point, is that the goals of the future for humanism are always shifting sand, and not the rock of Christ, who actually is determining the future and knows the end from the beginning, etc. So it's fascinating to me why the Olympic Games were even put in motion. It was to create a brotherhood of nations. But as Dr. Reshtoni says, the brotherhood of man is very real, but it's a brotherhood of murderers.
Right.
And it's not a brotherhood of blessedness. That's the way it's sold, but it's not the reality that results.
Right. I can remember back when President Carter pulled the United States out of the Olympics in Moscow because of the invasion of Afghanistan, and seeing real, real upset on the part of swimmers and whatnot, that this was a travesty because how dare politics get in the way of their sport when in actual fact it had a political motive from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it seems that humanism, when it's consistent, has its detractors all of a sudden.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. I know that you have written some science fiction yourself. Is there a view of science fiction that could be biblical?
I believe there can be. This is a point also that Doug Phillips has brought out. He asked the question, is this science fiction we're looking at, this particular specimen, is it lawful science fiction? In other words, does it comport not only with the laws of physics, so that we don't have things like time travel and whatnot that would violate causality or other principles of God's universe, but is also lawful in the moral dimensions? And those are the criteria that really need to be addressed. It seems to me that science fiction can be a very effective tool for shaping the future and being a vehicle. Unfortunately, it is the preeminent vehicle for humanism being propagated, and a lot of the Christian attempts at science fiction tend to be, I guess I would say, mildly veiled episodes or exercises in evangelism of various degrees of effectiveness and eloquence.
How has your orientation to writing science fiction differed from that?
Well, first, I believe that the biblical worldview has to trump everything else in the writing of the story. It should be written in the real world, ideally, not in the fantasy world, because it's in the real world that we deal with the kind of things that might come out. Also, I believe that all of nature, as Psalm 19 says, bears testimony to the power of God and his glory and wisdom. This should also be reflected in the science fiction. And science fiction in a Christian setting should then confront men with alternatives that they have no choice but to deal with in terms of the biblical categories. Therefore, that novel I wrote actually brings things like the poor tithe into play. Creationism, Van Til's apologetics comes into play, always at the service of the story, not oppressively slept on as an afterthought, but melded in with the other plot points so that it's not quite detectable. In fact, I can only speak to my story in this instance. The Christian component is like a little trickle at the beginning, appealing to the vision of Ezekiel 47, the little trickle that grows to a stream, to a brook, and to an impassable river, depending on where Ezekiel is standing as it progresses down into the Dead Sea. And so, too, something that becomes a little mite, if you will, a teeny little aspect of reality, the implications of it grow and extend until it dominates the story by the final third, and people are being pushed to confront the issues that are being raised by a scientific discovery, some to suppress it and others to want to reveal it. And so that tension becomes there because men, being men, will suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So there is a tremendous opportunity to explain and expose this aspect of man's character in a fictional setting. I think science, far from being a realm where the priests of science are perfect and sinless, as they're often represented to be, they're more prone than most, because of their station, to be subject to the effects of sin. We all are, but they tend to deny it and are surprised when people think that they're nothing but pure human in their orientation. I drew attention to this in an article in Faith for All of Life when I did an exposition of Dr. Reshtoni's thought relative to science, particularly reviewing his book Mythology as Science. And he has a tremendous little episode there about a scientist being interviewed, and he was very upset that anyone would even suggest that scientists like him would be doing anything harmful or suppressing any truth, because, of course, they stood for truth in our culture. No one else does. Mm-hmm. So they're carrying that flag of perfectionism for the scientist. And so they really do see themselves as a priestly class, and that's why they don't deal well with dissenters. A scientific dissent or a smaller side camp is always marginalized and put on the fringe and treated terribly. You know, the reviewers and the referees of journals do a lot of house cleaning to make sure that orthodoxy, as they conceive of it, is protected. So even that component of priesthood, preserving orthodoxy, lives in modern science. So we transferred these religious concerns into the scientific realm because, as Reshtuni said, the modern scientist is the closest thing to a magician, because he's all about control of nature. Not understanding nature so much, but understanding it in order to control it. And if you can control nature, you can control the future.
Right.
And so they look to man to be controllable as an aspect of nature rather than a creature of God.
And we certainly see this with the whole debate over climate change and how a lot of the scientists just want their fiat word. It's now settled science and we don't have to talk about it anymore. It's just the way it is. And anybody who thinks otherwise is misinformed at best and, you know, trying to lead people down a really bad path.
Yeah, they impugn the motives of the critics. It fascinated me to see the outrage over those emails that were revealed concerning the nature of the suppression of evidence. But that wasn't that was just something that was occurred recently. Folks like Steve McIntyre have been exposing the weakness of the climate change theories for years. Let me just give his website. It's climateaudit.org. Very heavy sledding, but worthwhile looking at. You can see that they don't even, the scientists that promote it, are always being held their feet to the fire for academic violations. It's astonishing that those who hold up the highest standards for academic integrity are the ones that are being slammed routinely for violating their own canons, because it's not anything other than in a worldview that will not brook any rivals.
Right. Well, we were mentioning your book. For those who are listening, it will be out this year, 2010, mm-hmm. and the first of the trilogy is entitled Hidden in Plain Sight. And I've read a number of early versions of it, and I can tell you that Martin has done just what he said he hoped to do, not hitting anybody over the head on the first couple of chapters as if it's going to be something other than an entertaining story. But in the midst of the story, he does work his reader over in terms of confronting certain things and then showing the difference between those who would use an advancement or a discovery to control others and the desire for those who would use it to give it as a benefit to man. So I encourage you all to look for that when we announce its release. There is a section in the chapter we're discussing that I think is very, very timely, even though it was penned a couple of decades ago. Rush says, because of the ignorance of the Bible and of Christian foundations, the erosion in historic American system is both deep and widespread. And he says that many of the people who are worked up over this problem are least prepared to cope with it because they lack Christian foundations. They can identify the problem. They can document the crisis, he says, by the hour. But they are basically humanistic in spite of themselves because of the radical ignorance of how the country was founded and on what premises. Don't you think that's what we get a lot of in the so-called conservative movement and talk radio and the people who will go on and on and on about what's going on but have no real solutions?
Correct. They usually appeal to the fact that we've departed from our moorings, our constitutional moorings, and if only we could get back to that past and follow the Constitution the way it's written, everything would be well. Well, that would be only true if you also brought back the character of the people that were governed by the Constitution originally. It's a package deal. And by segregating this out and saying, really, the problem is procedural, we have an environmental problem, which means a structural problem. And if we can just fix the structure, everything else will be right. And this, again, is humanistic planning. It finds the problem in everything but man's sin and moral character. And consequently, the solutions that are being touted are halfway houses at best. And they will fall apart because they do not deal with the root cause. You can keep chopping off cancerous parts of a body, but if it's leukemia and it's systemic, you're going to have to kill everything off because there's no overcoming it until you cure the leukemia. Same thing here. Until you address man's rebellion against God, he's not going to be capable of receiving liberty or freedom. He's always going to either, as Rush Dooney says, think in terms of we or in terms of I. He brings that story up of that Russian writer, as you recall, from mm-hmm. this chapter. And right. It's fascinating that we either have the collective state aggregating all the power and being the ultimate good, or the anarchistic individual becomes the god. But in either case, we end up with a despotism and a catastrophe for our culture, and liberty is disallowed. Liberty can only occur when God's law operates between all men. And the Constitution gave us at least a procedural morality, as Rush Dooney said, not a substantive morality, but a procedural morality to protect that environment and ensure that it could survive if we were willing to sustain our moral capital, that spiritual capital that the Americas had at that time.
Right. At first, when I became introduced to this way of thinking and I saw the title of one of Dr. Rush Dooney's books, The One and the Many, I didn't understand. I couldn't get my hands around what he was talking about, mostly because I was in the middle of the snowstorm, so I couldn't quite see that I was in a snowstorm. The choice is, it seems, today, without Christ, you're going to have totalitarianism on one hand or anarchy on the other. And it's only the Bible and the triune God that addresses the problem of the one and the many and how that's going to be resolved and solved.
Correct. They find their balance, if you will, only in the counsels of God. That's why the law of God is structured to protect the equal ultimacy of the individual and of the group. So we have both families of nations and nations coming to God, but we also have individuals worshiping Him. And so all these are protected in their proper spheres, and they are all called to be under God individually and answerable to God. It's only when we have that in terms of a moral framework that we can proceed into a future as God has it planned. Otherwise, God will bypass this generation and let it sink.
Right.
And that's the choice we have, because between us and God, there's nothing left, as Van Til said, but a test of strength. And God's
right.
going to win. God will win it.
Exactly. And then Rush concludes the chapter by making the statement that the inevitable result of humanism is tyranny. It's an inescapable result, and that the actual derivation of the word tyranny means secular rule, that is, rule by man rather than by means of God's law. So we're back to the verse that he constantly closed most of these chapters with, that unless the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. So what we're looking at now, and it's kind of I'm shuddering a little bit when you say things like God will possibly pass this generation by and let us sink. It's not without hope. The only time we're without hope is if we choose to do it our way as opposed to God's way.
Right. And of course, we have a counter movement inside this country. There's good news amidst the dark. There is light shining in the darkness, and the darkness is passing away, as 1 John 2:8 affirms. But yeah, it's going to be a war between light and dark. That's a spiritual war. I always have to quickly say that, because people are conceiving of these martial terms in physical reality.
Right.
We're not advocating. We believe that the word preached is more powerful than any physical weapon. Because ideas simply have endurance without death. I believe even John F. Kennedy acknowledged that point. And here's an idea, because it's God's idea that's going to be realized. It's God's plan for the future that's going to be realized, because He has determined it from the time ago, ages in past. It was His intention to bring about His ultimate plan, which is every man under his own vine and fig tree. We are far removed from that. But that is where everything is going to inexorably flow, and humanism is going to end up dying. We talk about a post-Christian age in terms of the future. The reality is that we are facing a post-humanist realm.
Right.
A future that ultimately will be post-humanist, and that's all to the good, because only liberty will only arise and be preserved outside of the parameters of rejection of God. Because when God's rejected, man becomes God. And when man becomes God, tyranny is ensured.
Right. And that's why, as Christians, we can look to with good expectations of the collapse of humanism. That doesn't mean it will always be pretty, but why would we want a system that at its root is thumbing its nose at God to survive? And so one of the things that Chalcedon is so interested in is equipping Christians who have a heart for the salvation of others and the restoration of our republic to become ready to pick up the pieces when these institutions crumble, and they are crumbling. And the homeschool movement and the Christian school movement are really good examples of this. For the past 20, 30 years, not everybody has bowed the knee to Baal, and the products of that education are much better prepared to say no to the humanistic statism that we face.
Yes, that is an undercurrent, and it's a powerful one, and it gives hope for the future. In fact, people who are homeschooling are operating in terms of a vision for the future that is in conflict with the humanistic vision. Humanists want those kids in public schools so they can shape them. When parents pull their children out, they're making a statement about the future, that my children are not going to be part of the humanist vision for the future. They're going to be part of God's vision for the future. Of course, now there's conflict, but that conflict is needful, because darkness and light, they're not going to be in agreement with one another. But
right.
the God is going to bless those parents who seek a future in terms of God, His law, His covenant, His gospel, and His word. And that's where we're inexorably headed, regardless of all the apparent trappings of humanistic power. Rome fell, And anything that is opposed to the kingdom of God will also ultimately fall. Hebrews 12, quoting from Haggai 2, talks about the shaking of all things so that the kingdom that cannot be shaken may remain. And so everything is inexorably on shaky ground until such time. And humanism and its vision of the future will also die. It won't die willingly because people have such abiding faith, ironically, that we use that word faith, in man. But this faith in man is misplaced, and it always ends up in tyranny. So the vision that man has is there because man has to have a vision, but he rejects God's part in that because man wants to be God. So we have the worst of both worlds under humanism.
Exactly. Well, thank you for your time, Martin. This brings our podcast to a close. Let me encourage you to visit my website, or my blog site actually, www.startyourhomeschool.com. And this past week, I just posted a study guide that is available for PDF download for those of you who are going through the Law and Liberty book and would like to use it as a text, if you will, teaching homeschool or in Christian school or even starting Bible studies or Law and Liberty study groups, so that people can be enhanced by Dr. Rushduni's expositions of these topics and be in a position to do just what Martin and I have talked about, pick up the pieces and help restore our Christian Republic. Thanks for joining us, and we'll hope to be with you soon. Bye-bye.